gas, your gas supply. We're here with the court warrant. Can you please open the door? Otherwise, there were lots of them opening it for you.
This is the exciting bit. I love this bit.
Which bit?
This bit. I love this bit.
I have been investigating how British Gas and other major energy firms are treating vulnerable customers during the cost of living crisis.
Welcome to JLab, a podcast brought to you by the Civic Journalism Lab at Newcastle University. My name's Ian Wiley, and in this episode, our guest is Paul Morgan Bentley, Head of Investigations at the Times newspaper. Paul has just won Investigation of the Year at the Press Awards for undercover work he did to expose the force-fitting of British gas meters in the homes of vulnerable people.
Now, the boss of British Gas, Centrica, has told ITV News he's gutted after an undercover investigation showed debt collectors forcing entry into homes to install prepayment meters. Operating on behalf of British Gas, the workers could be heard enjoying breaking into the properties of struggling customers.
In our conversation, Paul explains how he got involved in investigations, why he thinks undercover reporting is so important, and he offers advice for early career journalists on door knocking and converting work experience into proper jobs. But first, I want to find out more about the origins of his British Gas story.
There are these kind of ideas that investigative journalists get their tips by kind of shady people in pubs wearing sheepskin coats, kind of handing them a note, or on a park bench, you know, handing you a briefcase. It doesn't happen. You can get tips, but you have often you make your own luck, and you most of our best work, I think, comes out of just creative thinking and thinking what's going to happen in 6 months' time, what are people going to be talking about, what's going to affect people's lives in a year's time, that kind of thing, and what should we be looking at to serve those people. And with British Gas, it was the investigation came out in last winter, so it was around kind of January, February, March, when I was kind of working on it and writing it, 2023. But it was probably 9 months earlier or 6 months earlier. We often have investigations meetings, and we talk about different ideas and what we're working on. And there, during that week, there'd been a lot of noise about the upcoming winter and how hard that was going to be for people and the cost of living crisis. And I'd previously done some work looking into debt collection and the kind of aggressive side of debt collection, and just had this thought and raised this idea of why don't we have a look at what energy companies are doing when it comes to debt collection, because in 6 months' time, everyone's going to care about what the energy companies are doing. Everyone's bills are going up so much, and surely they're not doing really aggressive debt collection at this time, but who knows? And if they do, we need to stop that, or we need to kind of expose that. And then just through doing research, so it was one of these scandals that was kind of in plain sight because charities were warning about prepayment meters. And these are these meters that if you don't have enough money to top them up, they cut off your heating and electricity. And, you know, it was one of those issues where I think at other times, when it's not an energy crisis, people might not have quite wrongly, and I'm sure some people would argue, but might not have as much sympathy for people not paying their bills. But everyone could relate to the fact their bills were going up so much and could relate to the idea that if you don't have enough money to top up your bill, it's not because you're refusing to pay or, you know, being horrible about it or thinking that I don't have to pay my bills, someone else should pay them. It's because you genuinely can't afford it because they've gone up so much and because everything has gone up so much. And so charities were warning about prepayment meters and how families were going to be ending up in the cold in the winter because of being cut off. But the energy companies themselves kept insisting, whenever these things were written, that they did all they could to protect vulnerable people, that vulnerable people were not forced onto prepayment meters. And energy companies have, for some reason, this unique legal ability to apply to courts for warrants to break into customers' homes to force fit prepayment meters. So even if you don't want one, you could end up having one. And we, just as a kind of side thing, we can't do undercover work just kind of whenever we fancy it. There's a lengthy process we go through, lots of meetings with our lawyers in-house at the Times, goes right up to the most senior editors, and we discuss the public interest. So in that case, exposing something that is ending up cutting off vulnerable people from their heating in the winter, clear public interest, affecting, you know, millions of people potentially, versus the rights that people have to privacy and to not being intruded upon. And, you know, by going undercover, to an extent, you're intruding on people's privacy. There are people you're working alongside that don't know you're filming them. You know, and you can't just, it's not a decision we take lightly, ethically. You have to think about it really carefully. But when there's genuine public interest, there are times when we feel that it's justified. And so after that whole process, and actually with British Gas, I think it was the kind of perfect example, because what was really crucial is that there was no other way to find out this information. Charities were warning about it, but the energy companies themselves were arguing strongly back that they weren't doing anything wrong.
What did you suspect was happening that merited going undercover? Because I guess there's a threshold. You need to be fairly confident that there's something to find. What was it that you were hoping to find, or were fairly confident you would find if you went undercover, Paul?
That vulnerable people were being forced onto prepayment meters. So the companies were saying, we do not force vulnerable people on. We only do it when it's a last resort and it's genuinely justified. And I think it's very reasonable to think that it's not justified if it's a family with young children at home, or if it's someone who's severely disabled, or that has kind of known vulnerabilities. And what the charities were reporting very much looked like vulnerable people being targeted. Lots of vulnerable people were ending up with these, being forced fitted these meters, but the companies were saying, no, we've got very robust processes that prevent that happening. So there was this disparity there, and we felt that the only way to prove if that genuinely was happening definitively was by going undercover, and that the intrusion into the individual's privacy was justified because there was such a public interest. So we came to that conclusion, and then I applied. I found out through research that these companies use the third party agency to do their debt collection. There's a few agencies, but one in particular, and there were jobs going. And so after all those details discussions, I applied to work there undercover.
And that means in practice creating a different identity, a different CV?
Yeah, I have to be a bit careful because we can't kind of reveal all our processes, but actually, I think people would assume fake identities, and some undercover work, you do use fake identities. But actually, when it comes to employment, a job, you have to use your national insurance number. You have to use your ID. So, no, I use genuine documents. Yeah, if you Google my name, it's fairly obvious that I do undercover work. And obviously, there's some things that we do, and we don't, you know, I don't write a CV saying I'm head of investigations at the Times. But they're clearly not doing very thorough checks in these cases. At least that, you know, with the examples recently, that's been the case. So, yeah, I applied, used genuine ID documents and national insurance number, and had an interview, filmed the interview. And what we also do is we constantly reassess the public interest. So it's not like we decide we go undercover and then it's kind of blanket, let's just go film for 6 months. You, at each stage, you reassess with editors, with lawyers. And again, the interview, lots of worrying things were being said. And by the January, I was in the job and going out in teams of usually four or five men sent by British Gas. So what we found was this agency that worked for a number of energy companies. Most of the energy companies had stopped force fitting prepayment meters during that really cold period during the cost of living crisis. But British Gas were still doing it. So the teams that I was in, we kept being sent out to British Gas customers' homes with warrants to force fit prepayment meters. And then very crucially, I quickly was finding that the families were so obviously vulnerable. Not all of them, but we were being sent to homes where just, you know, it was known because the details were on the page. You know, the date of birth showed that this man was elderly, and yet we're being sent to with a warrant to force fit a prepayment meter there. Turned up at one home, and there was a mother there holding her four-week-old baby. And she later talked about how her bills had increased seven times during the previous months. So she was having to make these decisions between, you know, to wrap her kids up in layer upon layer to stop the heating bill, the heating being cut off because she didn't have enough money, or just keeping the meter going. And, you know, people were having to make these awful decisions. And so the more I did it, the more, you know, justified it was that clearly we were exposing something really bad happening. And then the other thing, while I was undercover, we were sent emails with notes from jobs across the country. So obviously I was in one team. And sometimes when you're undercover, the organisation or, you know, authority can come back and say, well, you just saw one bad egg at work or whatever. And what was really crucial was I was being sent these weekly documents, and they showed when homes were force fitted with prepayment meters from the previous week. And then there were notes. And in these notes, in black and white, were things like, customer has severe mental health, bipolar disorder, customer has a child who uses a hoist and a wheelchair. They call them PPM, prepayment meters. PPM fitted. And even when they knew that was the case.
At what point did you decide to stop the undercover, that you had enough? I mean, what was for you the threshold?
I think I was there for 3 weeks, and we just felt like we'd got to the point where we had such damning evidence that we had to publish. Also, actually, it was building as an issue generally. Like I said, it was kind of a known issue to an extent. And while I was undercover, there was this moment where the energy secretary at the time, Grant Shapps, had issued what looked like some kind of order for the companies to stop. It was a request, but the government were presenting it as an order. The government saying, well, we've told energy companies that they must stop force-fitting prepayment meters. Because of the concerns that charities were raising, also I should mention that the guy who was at the time the investigations correspondent there, Dean Kirby, had done great work covering the court hearings for the warrants to be granted, and showing how these hearings were just, you know, 3 minutes long, 4 minutes long, and hundreds were being okayed. So this idea that the courts were checking for vulnerabilities was nonsense. They were just pushing them through en masse. So because of his reporting as well, there was some noise. And yeah, while I was undercover, Grant Shapps announced that, well, this announcement went out that Grant Shapps has told the energy companies to stop force-fitting prepayment meters. That was reported on the Sunday, and then the next day on the Monday, and throughout that week, I kept being sent by British Gas to force fit these meters after the minister had supposedly ordered them to stop. So after a week of that, we thought, we've got so much damning evidence now. And so we published, and partly because of that, the noise and the reporting that had already happened, when we published, I've never had this before, it just exploded. And the government and the regulator acted so quickly to suspend companies from doing this. So not just a letter saying, please stop of your own accord, but proper legal action to stop them. Sometimes it's kind of the ultimate goal with investigative journalism, I think, is to create some kind of change the law, change things in people's lives for the better. I've never had that before where it's so quickly had an effect. So that was great.
And was there any serious challenge from British Gas or the agency you're working for that looked like they could prevent you from publishing at any point?
No, and that actually in this case, I think the footage was so damning, and we, as well as publishing, I mean, it's just common for us now, instead of just thinking about words, throughout, I'd been working with the video team at the time. So the undercover footage, as well as just putting that out, they'd been filming me when I was going to work and things like that to create essentially a mini documentary. And we did a podcast episode and we had all this stuff ready. And I think because we'd share, you know, they could see the footage and it was so damning and so obvious that they shouldn't have been doing this. Sometimes organisations can be very aggressive back and send all these legal letters and stuff like that. And actually British Gas, or Centrica, which owns British Gas, held their hands up. And the CEO of Centrica was all over the news the next day, over the TV, on the radio, saying sorry. And they stopped using the third-party agency. And there's still an investigation into British Gas ongoing by Ofgem, the regulator. But across the industry, it was suspended. And then since then, the law has changed to to make it really clear when they cannot force fit these meters. So for instance, for anyone over 75 who lives alone, for anyone with children under 2 years old. Yeah, so that was the kind of later repercussions, the legal change, but also there was immediate apology and also action to stop this happening.
I mean, you've alluded to a couple of reasons why undercover work is so crucial and important sometimes. Is there anything else that you particularly, maybe enjoy is the wrong word about it, but particularly appreciate about the role of undercover work? And then is there anything about it does make you feel uncomfortable, or, you know, just from a practical point of view?
I feel uncomfortable when it's used too much. You know, I think there's such value in it sometimes, you know, rarely. It shouldn't be used often. And it, historically, organisations have fallen foul of that. And, you know, kind of notorious stings. And, you know, there is tighter regulation in the newspaper industry now, in the news industry. And, you know, people argue there should be more and more independent regulation. And, you know, I'm not going to get into all of those discussions here. But my experience is that the regulator currently is much stronger than it used to be. And will and very thoroughly dissects, when there are complaints, the process of going undercover, rightly, to make sure that it's not just people chucking on cameras whenever they want. And you have to think very carefully about subterfuge when you can use it. So I get uncomfortable when it's used too much. I think there is, British Gas shows the real value in using it when it's justified. And it exposes things in the public interest that could never be exposed without those things being caught on camera, because there could always be arguments that that's not what happened, or no, we didn't know that was the case. Or when you see the footage in front of your eyes, you can't argue that away. And I think that is what caused such swift change in the case of the British Gas scandal. But yeah, all it takes, you know, I think as an investigative journalist, actually, not just undercover work, all your work, your reputation is so important. Internally, I mean, within an organisation, you know, because separately, externally, you have reputations. But if you start getting complaints that are upheld against you and you're not really, really on top of accuracy, if you're the type of person who is not making small mistakes, that your editors can trust you when you're fighting for these things. But if you are careless and you make accuracy mistakes, even on small things, it creates insecurity. It creates that feeling that you can't be trusted to do this kind of work. And so it is incredibly important that when we do this kind of work, that we are extremely careful. But actually, like I said, it's not just undercover work. It applies generally. You know, I feel very passionately that you have to be very careful that there are no silly mistakes in your copy. Because if you get complaints upheld that regularly, you get a reputation and then you can't be trusted to do this kind of work. Even when you have the footage, there's not kind of carte blanche to then publish it. We then sit down again and have more meetings about what we're justified to include, what we shouldn't include, what needs to be blurred. Is there anyone that we won't blur? Because what they've done is so crucial that is seen. Are there people that should be blurred? Part of that with British Gas was blurring the interiors of the homes. So if you watch the video, it starts with us knocking on a door and one of the debt collectors kind of very brashly saying things, something like, you know, oh, I love this bit, when the locksmith is getting to work, breaking into the home. But then when we go inside, we black the screen, because that is someone's personal place. They haven't asked for us to come in. Although actually, I went back to the young mother I talked about with the four-week-old baby. I went back to her afterwards, before we published, and told her that I'd been undercover as part of the team. And that was one of those examples where, you know, she could have told me to bugger off, but she didn't. And she invited me in, and she was delighted we were doing the work we were doing and that we could help her potentially by raising the issue publicly. And she actually agreed that she said she was happy for us to show inside her home as long as she was blurred and her baby was blurred. And so we did that. And, you know, so with her, it was with her permission. So And that was when I came back as a journalist, that she told me about her bills going up 7 times and the full story about what she'd been going through. And she had other children. Actually, when we turned up with the warrant to break into her home, her key was in her front door already. She'd left it in the front door. And anyone who's had a young child will be able to relate to that feeling. You know, how could you ever argue that that person with a 4-week-old baby isn't vulnerable and doesn't need support? And it was really powerful going back to her.
Was there a light bulb moment where you thought, journalism, news, that's my thing?
I'm a big believer in just being really open-minded and taking opportunities as they come if you feel good about them, and working hard and seeing where life takes you. And I was absolutely not one of these people who aged 8 was saying, I'm going to be a journalist. I've never been the type of person who's been that interested in the kind of politics of journalism or who the big names are, or, you know, I've never been someone who was desperate to have someone else's job. I kind of naturally veered towards subjects like English and history and politics and things like that. And I, towards my late teens, started really enjoying sitting down with newspaper supplements in particular. Kind of picture myself aged about kind of 16 reading Catlin Moran and Giles Corrin on a Saturday and thinking, I'd love to do that. And when I started, in my mind, that kind of nugget of an idea, I kind of thought I'd veer towards lifestyle journalism and kind of wanted to write funny features and things that, you know, related to people's day-to-day lives in a kind of lighter way, maybe. And it was only basically through doing it that I realised that I preferred doing other stuff. And so at university, I wrote a bit for student publications, and then I did a postgrad in journalism at Goldsmiths. And at the time, the course there was very veered towards kind of magazines. There was a news course as well, but it tended to attract kind of lifestyle writers, people that wanted to do that kind of journalism. But it was only through doing that course that I really realised that I loved news. And I did loads of work experience, and I used to, every Friday, I'd managed to get work experience at the Times, actually, and on a supplement at the time they had called Body and Soul, which was on a Saturday. And it was kind of quite early days of people consuming news online and journalism online. And it was this old fashioned process where they produced everything for the paper and then they just upload it word for word onto the website. And the Saturday supplements that would be uploaded on a Friday. And the way the university course I was on worked was that Fridays were quieter. And while I was on work experience, I managed to convince them to let me come in on Fridays. I mean, it didn't take much convincing because they weren't paying me, but to come in and do that really manual thing of uploading. But it was a way of just getting in the building. And then I started pitching features. I pitched one on going to, I played to my strengths. I pitched stuff on university type of stuff, student type of stuff, but it got me in the building. And then there one time I kept coming back for more work experience at the supplement and filling in when their kind of most junior staff weren't available. And one time there was a call from the news desk saying, does anyone have a work experience person? We really could do with more hands on deck. And I went over to the newsroom and I just loved it. And I loved the pace of it and things that, you know, I was doing kind of fact file type things. The type of thing that on Body and Soul, I'd be working on for a week and then might go in on the Saturday, I was doing in half an hour. And then in the next day's paper, my name was in the paper. And I just found it so exciting and I totally veered and decided I wanted to be a news reporter.
How did you manage to consolidate your work experience role into a fully paid position?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is huge value in doing work experience and partly just being someone that people get on with, because people don't expect students or people just starting out to know everything. And I think that's a mistake that some people can make and think they have to be this like uber impressive person who's acting like they're going to be running the place in 5 years. And actually, that's not really what you want. What you want is someone to come in and just be a really nice presence and to be really helpful. And, you know, you're working on something, help with research, help with, even kind of go off to make a few cups of tea, stuff like that. Someone who's just nice to be around. For me, actually, it was funny. I was doing loads of work experience at the Times, and I kind of fluked something. At the time, it was around the time of the recession in kind of 2008, 2009. And so a lot of the news organisations had frozen training schemes, but the Daily Mail was doing a reporter scheme. And I applied for that, and the Times was as well, but there was only two places on the Times scheme and there were more places on the Daily Mail one. So the scheme was only a year, but I think everyone got kept on, almost everyone. And it was a real kind of, you got chucked around and you had to have thick skin and you just had to be willing to learn. And we had initial couple of weeks of training in London and then got sent off to regional papers for more training. And I was working at the Manchester Evening News, which was amazing. I loved it there. And then came back and was in London and did a couple of years of night shifts. And the night shifts at the time were kind of officially 5 p.m. to 1 a.m. or 6 p.m. to 2 p.m. That kind of, those times are ingrained in my brain because I did them so much. But they'd call you early. You were this extra resource. So quite often at 11 a.m., you'd get a call being like, can you just go out on this story? Because you're one of our night reporters. So you do these epic shifts. And I don't know, it wasn't that long ago, but I'm not sure that would be tolerated to the same extent now. But we all just got on with it. And it was kind of a dog-eat-dog environment. But I enjoyed it. I liked, you know, as long as I didn't have anything major on, I liked those early call-outs. And what that would involve usually was there'd be a breaking news story. So let's say someone had been murdered, I don't know, pick a town, you know, somewhere, let's say somewhere in Hertfordshire, and the senior reporters would be working on it and overseeing it, and they'd be, you know, so the senior reporters would be sent to the important addresses, like the address of the victim or the trying to find out who the perpetrator was, things like that. And they'd send the young night reporters, the trainees, to things like, oh, we've also got an address for a cousin. The kind of real speculative stuff. But what I found was that actually quite often the people right at the centre of the story, you wouldn't necessarily, sometimes they invite you in and you get the full story from them and they want to speak. But also sometimes you can get something great from a cousin or an uncle or a, you know, and you'd find that sometimes you'd end up with your name on the front page. And it wouldn't be the first name, it might be the third or fourth byline. But it was a way of proving yourself and showing that you could charm people and you could get in the door and people wanted to talk to you. And a big part of that job at the Mail, being a news reporter, was being the type of person that people invite in and just want to talk to. People go into journalism thinking it's all about writing, and actually a lot of the job is about being and just being the type of person that people want to talk to, people open up to, not being too intimidating in a way. You know, showing vulnerability yourself so that people also show vulnerability. And
maybe you can just expand the vulnerability thing.
Being empathetic is the most important thing. I think you can stay in your own mind and get in your own head about, oh, I'm scared about making this phone call, or I'm scared what they're going to say, or I'm. But take a second to think not about yourself, but about that other person. They've had something major enough happen that there's interest from a news organisation to come and knock on their door. How would it feel if someone knocked on your door? So I think just turning up and really feeling or trying to feel what they might be feeling and not trying to manipulate them or convince them in a way that doesn't suit them. Genuinely, when someone gets murdered, when the worst things happen, people, you know, can find real comfort in someone coming and just listening to them and not interjecting too much when they're talking, like letting them talk. I had this, I recently, just in the last couple of months, did an investigation into prisons. And one thing I found, it was an undercover job, and I was undercover at a prison, Bedford Prison. And one thing I found when I was there was that an inmate had died, and the circumstances looked a bit worrying. So I, you know, remembered his name and afterwards tried to find out his family and found his parents and went and knocked on their door. And it was a real example of that. They were so happy that I'd come and wanted to tell his story and what had happened. It was really shocking in the end. And he had a heart condition and they showed me evidence, these papers, applications he'd written while in prison saying, I need to get my heart monitor into my cell. And he'd asked four times, he said, and then he died. And they were so thankful and they've kept in touch with me, and it was his funeral the other day. And you know, for them, actually, some listen, you have to have thick skin, because sometimes you knock on someone's door in that situation and they swear at you and you get out of the place, you know, and you have to know that might happen. But my experience is actually that more often than not, you get invited in. And if you turn up and you knock on a door and you say, I'm here from a news organisation, it's really important you speak to me, you're going to get their backs up. But if you just say, hi, I'm here, you know, this is, we know this has happened and that it's in the news, and we'd love to hear what you think about it and you what you want, if you're happy to, I'd love to listen. And you know what, I genuinely, more often than not, people do want to speak.
Why is it important that we still make those calls, we make those visits, we have those conversations?
In my mind, all you're doing is offering an opportunity. And listen, if you knock on someone's door and they say no, and you stick around and you refuse to leave the area, that is massively crossing an ethical line in my mind. If you call someone and they put the phone down on you, and then you persist in getting in touch with them, and then you send them a Facebook message, and then, you know, there's often kind of door knocks seem like a dirty word, but it, I don't know, my experience actually, if you're writing loads of messages to someone, you know, why is it worse to show up at someone's door in person and offer them that opportunity? As long as you respect what they say back to you, that is the important thing for me. So I see it as offering an opportunity, and if they say no, absolutely you respect that and you leave. But what's the other situation with my prison investigation? I find out this guy's died in prison, and what some might say is the thing you should do is get in touch with the prison authorities. You know, speak to the Ministry of Justice and they'll contact the family for you and see if they want to speak to you. What would have happened had I done that? Absolutely nothing. And what the consequence of that is, that fact about that man dying after he had requested his heart monitor several times and the prison was in such a chaotic state that they didn't get it to him, and the fact that that death is now being investigated, and the family are distressed about it and want to stop other families suffering in a similar way, that would all be prevented if you went through, in my opinion, if you went through the prison authorities. Because do you trust the government to do that job for you and to do it honestly, even though it damages their reputation? Absolutely not. So in my mind, I offered them an opportunity and they were so delighted to have been given that opportunity and wanted to tell their story. So it's just about offering that opportunity. And I would argue against anyone about the ethics of that, because partly because of my experience. And, you know, there will have been times early in my career that I'm sure I got it wrong and that I didn't leave an area quick enough because I was desperate to get a result or whatever. But later on in my career now, I think I've got to a point where I can absolutely see where the ethical lines are. And as long as you're offering an opportunity in a respectful way, that's the most important thing. And I really would kind of appeal to people, if they can, to make those approaches in person. To, you know, when you're in person, you notice details. They, you know, you'll see something in their house that might spark a conversation that never would have happened over email. You know, some of the best reporters, hear about political reporters who are just on the phone constantly, because they're trying to find out information. And, you know, often with an investigation, you make that first call and that leads to another call and that leads to another call. And before you know it, you're speaking to someone really crucial who wants to speak to you. And had you not made those first 15 phone calls, you never would have got there. So I think there's huge value in that. When I was at the Mail, the news editor there was Ben Taylor, who's now editor of the Sunday Times. He's an amazing journalist. And when we started the investigations team there, he said to me and Catherine something like, I want you to get this kind of idea of investigations, this kind of, you know, it's a word that has associations with it of kind of, you know, Watergate and these big things. And he said, forget all that. And just, I want you to deliver good stories that people want to read and take more time over them and go really in depth. And if you need to go undercover because it justifies it, let's do that, and let's be really bold and ambitious. But at the end of the day, if it's not a really engaging story that people care about, it doesn't mean anything. And I really, you know, think about that all the time, and it has to be stuff that people care about. You know, you're serving your readers.
You've been listening to JLab, a podcast brought to you by the Civic Journalism Lab at Newcastle University. My name's Ian Wiley. Thanks for tuning in.